Welcome to episode 246 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com for Survivor Series Sunday, November 18th, 2012. I am the Solid Monster. Big pay-per-view coming up tonight from Indianapolis, Indiana. It is the WWE Survivor Series show. We got to talk about that. Talk about Raw, Impact, a couple of other news and notes. I heard something went down on Monday night that had some people talking. I can't imagine what that is. We'll get to all that. But first, Survivor Series coming up tonight. AJ Lee posted a note on Twitter late yesterday that she will apparently have evidence of her own to present against one Vicky Guerrero at the pay-per-view. Evidence of what? I have no idea. But apparently they will be doing another one of these soap opera skits on the pay-per-view, which I hate. I don't want this shit on Raw, let alone on pay-per-view. I guess we're going to get it. Main event is the WWE Champion CM Punk defending against John Cena and Ryback in a triple threat match. John Cena went on Twitter this morning and said that apparently he's debuting new gear tonight. So trying to think what colors he could do next. He's pretty much done all of them, hasn't he? He's done pink, he's done green, he's done blue, he's done red, he's done orange. I guess maybe he could do lavender or something and just get it over with, but he'll be debuting new gear tonight, which I'm sure has people very excited to spend their money on this pay-per-view. WWE Champion CM Punk is now in the midst of, what, 360-something days, I think, at this point, as the champion. It was at Survivor Series 1 year ago at Madison Square Garden, I know because I was there, where Punk defeated Alberto Del Rio to win the title. He has been the champion every single day since. So I don't know if it's tonight or tomorrow that officially marks 365 days. I've lost count. But basically, if he gets through Survivor Series with the championship intact, which I think and hope he will, he will officially mark 1 year as the WWE champion, which in today's day and age is a rare feat for anybody to hold any championship, let alone the top championship for a year straight, is quite the feat that he should be very proud of. And my hope is that Punk will make it into the pay-per-view with the title. He'll make it out. And all roads lead to The Rock at the Royal Rumble. Don't mess it up. You've got a good thing here. There's no reason to take the title off Punk. I'm going with CM Punk as my prediction for this match. And as far as how it goes down, my guess would be that John Cena ends up taking the fall in this match because you don't want to beat Ryback a second time in a month. I mean, it was one thing to beat Ryback the way they did with the Brad Maddox finish at Hell in a Cell because you had to. I mean, there really was no way out of it. They kind of painted themselves into a corner. You had to come up with some sort of fuck finish where Ryback was going to have to suffer his first loss, and they did it. And they did it in a way that protected Ryback. I don't think it did too much damage to him. And he certainly got his revenge on Maddox on Monday night. But to beat Ryback again, to voluntarily beat Ryback again, when you didn't have to do that. Remember, Ryback originally was not supposed to be in a triple threat match for the title. He was supposed to be in a Survivor Series elimination match, where I'm almost positive he probably would have been the sole survivor, or at least one of the survivors, and you know, giving him a big win. To change that and put him in a match where he would take the fall doesn't make any sense to me. So my guess is John Cena, you know, gets beat up by, I mean, who knows? Maybe by Ryback, and then Ryback gets distracted by Heyman or something, and Punk steals the pin. But Punk will retain the title. I have faith, and that would be the correct finish for this match. World Heavyweight Championship match, The Big Show defends against Sheamus in a rematch from Hell in a Cell last month. Big Show just won the belt from Sheamus at the last pay-per-view, not even a month, it was 3 weeks ago. And, you know, if you're going to keep this thing going, no reason to take the title of Big Show. You already gave him the championship. I mean, why swap it back 3 weeks after you changed it? Big Show, you know, for whatever you can say about this feud, and I think they've handled the feud well. For the most part, I did not like the fact that Sheamus came out on Raw after Hell in a Cell all happy and jolly, you know, 24 hours removed from losing his championship. I thought that was stupid. But I like the way that they booked the Big Show as the champion. He's a badass. You know, he goes around to pubs beating people up, and he's a perfect heel champion for Sheamus to go after. He's done very well in the role so far. And if Sheamus gets the belt back from Big Show, I suppose, you know, he'll be in line for a rematch at the next pay-per-view, which would be TLC, and then Sheamus wins the rematch and you blow it off. So actually, I mean, when you think about it like that, I guess I could see them changing the title, because if Big Show beats him, or at least Sheamus, just whatever the finish is, doesn't win the championship, this carries on for another month. When Sheamus does ultimately win the belt back, and he will, Big Show will still be owed a rematch, which means that this then drags on into the new year. And I don't know how long they want to drag this out for, but I'll stick with my original prediction, which is Big Show retains the title. That's just, you know, my thought on this. But again, they could easily do the title change here, blow off the feud with the rematch at TLC next month, and then Sheamus can move on to whatever his next feud is going to be heading into WrestleMania. So we'll see what they do. Survivor Series Elimination Match, the only one officially on the show. I guess they could add something. There's a bunch of people who are not on the show. Primetime Players, Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara. They could end up doing something with those guys. But we have Team Foley, which is the combination of Randy Orton, Kofi Kingston, Daniel Bryan, Kane, and The Miz. Yes, The Miz, who went babyface, officially, I think, on Monday night. They'll take on Team Ziggler, formerly Team Punk. It'll be the combination of Dolph Ziggler, Alberto Del Rio, Wade Barrett, Damian Sandow, and Cody Rhodes. And Cody Rhodes took a bad spill. He had a bad landing on a backdrop by Kane during a match that was taped for main event. It was Rhodes Scholars against Hell No. And pretty nasty looking if you saw the clip. Latest update per Cody Rhodes' own Twitter is that an MRI showed he suffered a torn trapezius muscle, a torn deltoid, and a separated shoulder. This is all in addition to a concussion that he was diagnosed with. He said no surgery would be required. He actually credited his partner, Damian Sandow, with protecting and saving his career. Because during that match, you know, Cody, the match didn't end. Cody was in a bad way. He tagged out. He was out on the apron. You could see he was hurt. He was in some level of distress. And I guess should have been tagged back into the match. And Sandow refused to tag him in because he could probably tell how badly Cody was hurt. And so Cody thanked him on Twitter for essentially saving his career by doing that, which I thought was kind of cool. But even though no surgery was required, I mean, all these different injuries, and forget the torn muscles and all that stuff. If they give him another impact test, which is what they refer, that's the name they have for their concussion testing. If they test him today, which I believe they are going to do if they haven't already, and they find that he is still suffering the after effects of that concussion, they will not let him wrestle, even if he feels he is able to do so. So I would think that the chances of him wrestling on the pay-per-view tonight are probably very slim, and if in fact he does not wrestle, Tenzai reportedly would be his replacement, and what a replacement that would be. Tenzai replacing Cody Rhodes, potentially, in this Survivor Series match. Doesn't look good for Team Ziggler right now. So as far as who wins, Team Foley, Team Ziggler, you know, to me, it doesn't really matter, I suppose. I was at last year's Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden where they had a traditional Survivors match just like this one. And the teams really are not all that much different this time around. Last year, you had Wade Barrett, Cody Rhodes, and Dolph Ziggler, all part of the heel team opposing a babyface team that included both Randy Orton and Kofi Kingston, two men who once again find themselves on the same side. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I had somebody else write into me saying that Wade Barrett has been involved, I think, in a Survivor Series traditional match the last 3 years in a row or something like that. So some interesting items there. These people seem to be running in place like hamsters in a wheel. They never seem to really advance much higher than the level they're at, which is kind of distressing, actually, because Dolph Ziggler and Wade Barrett are arguably two guys that should already be world champions. It's my opinion. Hopefully this time next year they will be, or at least one of them will be. I'll go with Team Foley in this match if I had to pick a winner. I think Team Foley will pull it out. I don't know who the sole survivors will be, but here's my take on this. I don't see Randy Orton taking the losing fall 2 years in a row. Randy Orton took a wasteland from Wade Barrett last year and got pinned. And Barrett and Cody Rhodes were the sole survivors in that match. Let's just say I don't see that happening again. So I will go with Team Foley, and I do not think Randy Orton will be eliminated. I do think he'll be part of the winning troop. Divas Championship on the line. Eve Torres defending against Caitlyn. I figure they may put Caitlyn over here, give her a title win. I'll go with Caitlyn in this match. We have Antonio Cesaro. Although I will say, just back to the Divas for a second, I have heard rumors that they are pushing towards an Eve Torres-AJ Lee feud, possibly for the Divas Championship. So would not shock me if Eve retained, but I think they'll give Caitlyn the win, and Eve could always, you know, win it back in the rematch. Antonio Cesaro and R-Truth for the United States Championship. Going to go with Antonio in this match. No reason to take the title off him. I think he's done very well in the role so far. And the pre-show match, Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel against the three-man band, which will likely be the combination of Heath Slater and Jinder Mahal, as many of you pointed out to me when I mentioned on the show last week that Drew McIntyre was going through some tough times. His mother had fallen ill. I was not aware that she had passed away. I was not in the loop on a lot of things last weekend, because last weekend I was quite busy. So excuse me for not knowing that Drew McIntyre's mother died. I didn't know that was such an important thing to know. I did know she was sick. Unfortunately, I take it she had been suffering from cancer for quite some time, which just sucks. I've talked about cancer before. And she has passed away, so that's very sad to hear. So I don't know that Drew will be at the pay-per-view tonight. My guess would be, even if he is, he won't be wrestling. And I'll go with three-man band. They're getting the big push of late. You know, Justin Gabriel and Tyson Kidd, great tag team, but they're not exactly in line for a push as far as I know. So I'll go with the three-man band. And that's your Survivor Series rundown for the big pay-per-view coming up tonight. Which leads into Monday Night Raw, which was the go-home show to the Survivor Series this past Monday night from Columbus, Ohio. This was the go-home show to Survivor Series, and what a go-home show it was. The question is, did it get you any more interested in paying to see the pay-per-view? That is the question. And when it was over, I can't really say that it did that for me, but I will say that I enjoyed the show. There was something about it, it just felt like a big show. You had three major things to promote on this show. One was a main event, a pay-per-view caliber main event of John Cena versus CM Punk, which we've seen a million times, but it's still a big match and would have been your Hell in a Cell main event had Cena not gotten injured. Now, they did not announce this the week before, as they should have on television. They announced it on WWE.com a couple of hours before the show, which was dumb. But they did announce two other big things for the show. One, of course, being the return of Jerry the King Lawler for the first time since his heart attack, and a Ryback-Brad Maddox match that Vince McMahon personally signed, sealed, and delivered on the show the week before. He said that if Maddox could beat Ryback, he would not only give him a WWE contract, but he would give him a $1 million WWE contract. And I was pretty much entertained throughout the 3 hours, with a couple of exceptions here and there. I like this show. One of our listeners, Mihail from Romania, he was bored during Raw Monday night, and in his time of boredom, he decided to calculate a couple of things, one of which, he calculated that over the course of 2 hours and 15 minutes, and I assume he's subtracting time for the commercials to get to that number, we got about 44 minutes of actual wrestling on the show Monday night, which, not for nothing, is actually pretty good by WWE standards. I know it doesn't sound good on a three-hour wrestling show to have not even an hour of wrestling, but again, when you take out the commercials and you take out the skits and the backstage segments and, you know, the Did You Know facts and the Twitter polls and all the bullshit that we usually get, 44 minutes, hey, I'll take it, of actual in-ring time. So let's move along here. I know everybody is interested in getting my thoughts on a certain segment on the show, and We'll get on with it here. Although, in this case, I may upset some people with what I have to say. Randy Orton beat Dolph Ziggler with a roll-up to open the show after some foiled interference from Alberto Del Rio and Ricardo Rodriguez. After the match, Orton was outnumbered by the heels. Kofi Kingston ran in to make the save, which brought out Teddy Long, whose rationale for being there was, Vicky Guerrero is just too damn busy gathering evidence linking John Cena and AJ Lee. Two single people, mind you, who, according to her, are having a, quote, affair. So, therefore, he had the authority, Teddy Long did, on behalf of SmackDown GM Booker T, to step in and make a tag team match. That's right, playa. He made a tag team match of Orton and Kofi against Alberto and Ziggler, and Del Rio ended up pinning Kofi with a Shining Wizard to the back of the head. I guess we know who the weak link of that team is at Survivor Series. When we came back from break, Dolph was still in the ring with Vicky for the next chapter in Days of Our Lives. Dolph was an Iron Man on this show. He already competed in two matches and now a promo up to this point. They recapped the previous hidden cam footage of Cena and AJ together, including Dolph ragging on Cena for wearing his wrestling gear to dinner. They invited AJ to come out one last time, try to explain herself. She got a huge pop. If this angle is good for one thing, it's done more to rehab the AJ character than anything else. People were just... they just were not into her as the GM. And personally, I think part of that was the way that she was dressed. You know, you go from having AJ, cute girl, very attractive, coming out every week wearing skimpy clothing, and, you know, at least for the first several weeks of her as GM. I know after a while she started wearing this ridiculous outfit as the GM, where it was like part suit but no pants, and that was an improvement. But for the longest time, she was wearing like a full bodysuit, and it's like, you know, why are you going to take away one of the advantages of having this very attractive girl who usually comes skipping out to the ring in skimpy attire, and now you're going to dress her up? It just didn't make any sense. So she said that she and Cena were just friends, nothing more. And Vicky played us some secret voicemails left for John Cena by AJ, and it was at this point that I realized they really are ripping off the Claire Lynch angle in TNA. I mean, they are not even trying to hide it at this point. They're just, they don't have any shame at all. They're just like, you know what? TNA did this crappy angle. We could do this crappy angle even better than they could. So that's really what it is. And speaking of ripping off TNA, they appear to be using that voiceover guy in the recap package each week now at the start of Raw, just like TNA does. I pointed this out weeks ago that not only did it reek of TNA production, but it actually sounded like it might be the same guy who does the voiceovers on Spike for TNA, doing them for WWE. I don't know if it's the same guy or not. It might be. But clearly they're ripping that off TNA as well. It's cheesier than a bag of Doritos, but I don't have a problem with them doing those voiceovers. It's a nice way to bring people up to speed on all the key angles. But again, not even trying to hide the fact they're copying off a promotion that they don't even acknowledge as competition. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So AJ was alarmed by these voicemails. She claimed that they must have been hacked. From John Cena's phone was hacked. And they used the audio equivalent, I guess, of Photoshop to doctor these voicemails. And this brought out Cena. He was all business for a change. No funny jokes. No comedy. No funny faces. Why the long face, John? All of a sudden, he's all serious. He went after Dolph. AJ stood in his way, and instead, she smacked Ziggler across the face. And what a smack it was. Ziggler was sporting a nice shiner later in the show, backstage. I mean, it could have been makeup, I guess, but I figure she just stiffed him on the slap. And in the next segment, backstage, John Cena said he was sorry for all of this happening to AJ, because it's not like they would ever actually be together. And this seemed to bother AJ. Uh-oh, crazy chick alert. Run, Cena, run! Next week, we're going to find out that she made rabbit stew out of his bunny or something. Big Show made short work of William Regal in a non-title match, a rare in-ring appearance on Raw for Mr. Regal. It was too short to matter, but I like this match. It was mostly a squash, but it was a stiff match. Both guys just tore into each other. And at the end, Regal's chest looked like raw meat. This was just two dudes beating the crap out of each other. Good stuff. I liked it. Caitlyn beat Layla in 1:08, according to the Divas stopwatch, to become the number one contender to Eve's championship. And the match lasted almost as long as it took me to say that. Then we have the triumphant return of Jerry the King Lawler, just 2 months removed from suffering a near-fatal heart attack at the announce desk. I said on the sound-off, not long after that happened, that I looked forward to the day when Lawler would make his Raw return, and the hero's welcome I'm sure that he would receive from the crowd, that it would go down as one of the greatest moments in the history of Monday Night Raw. That's what I said, because that's what I felt. You know, here's a man that is... been on so many Raws over the years. I wonder if there's been anybody else that has appeared on more Raw shows than Jerry Lawler. Maybe Jim Ross, but probably not even Jim Ross, because Lawler was there far before JR was doing commentary on Raw. So he's been on the show for so long. He's, you know, been such a big part of it, and really, for all intents and purposes, should not be here. He was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time when the wrong thing happened. And I was looking forward to him coming back. Again, I still feel as though the announced situation could be handled a little bit differently. You know, Lawler, not necessarily what he used to be, and part of that is just the way that things are with the TV show now. He's not a heel. He's a face. And really, he should never be a heel again, especially after the reaction. After the heart attack, that sealed the deal. I mean, not that they were going to be turning Lawler heel anytime soon, but it's kind of like Michael Cole, for example. It was a perfect excuse to have Michael Cole stop doing his heel shtick and start being a straight play-by-play babyface announcer, which he's not bad at. You know, he's certainly a lot better than he was when he was all obnoxious on commentary every week, burying every single person on the roster. The heart attack was a great excuse to drop it and let him be what he should be, which is the straight play-by-play guy. And in the case of Lawler, it's just, you know, you can never turn him heel again, even though I think he's far better in that role. But anyway, the point is, for a few minutes on this show, that's exactly what happened. We got one of the greatest moments in the history of Monday Night Raw. It was everything it should have been. Jim Ross introducing Lawler. He comes out to a huge ovation. He hugs JR and Michael Cole, the man who helped save his life. He gets on the mic, tears in his eyes. He thanks the fans. He compares what he's gone through to the movie It's a Wonderful Life, which I thought was a great analogy. And you could just tell how moved Lawler was by everything. It's not often we see emotion from Jerry Lawler. We see manufactured emotion in the course of an angle, you know, where he gets really angry. He's very good at that. But I don't know that I've ever seen Jerry Lawler cry on Raw before. So it was a very moving moment in that respect. You know, the man really shouldn't be here right now, but he is. And that's definitely something to be thankful for. So this really was right up there for me as one of the best feel-good moments, you know, in the history of the show. Right up there with Ric Flair's retirement ceremony back in 08, which may well still be the best moment in Raw history. In fact, I still feel it is. That's why I ranked it number one when I did that whole top 30 Raw moments countdown show several episodes back. And then CM Punk's music hit, and you could just hear the wrestling world collectively groan. I have gotten more angry emails about this segment than I have any other single segment, maybe in the history of me doing this podcast. There were some people defending it, of course, but they were in the minority. One such person defending it was Marcus, who had this to say. He wrote into the show. He says, "My uncle has suffered a heart attack before, and when he watched the Paul Heyman CM Punk segment on the show, he thought it was hilarious. Why feel sorry for those who have had heart attacks? It's real life. I'm sure Jerry Lawler was fine with that, rather than having people feel sorry for him and crying. People need to stop sounding like soccer moms. For example, Seth MacFarlane makes fun of cancer on Family Guy all the time, and his mother died of cancer. Laughing in the face of death works for a lot of people. As Vince McMahon says, take a negative and turn it into a positive. In this case, Punk needed the hate from the fans," end quote. Now, let me first disagree with that last point that Marcus makes, because I think that is such a bullshit cop-out excuse I've heard people use over the past week. And I'm not singling out Marcus, I'm just saying I've heard this argument from other people. Punk needed the heat. CM Punk did not need any hate or any heat. He is the biggest heel in the company right now. He is the biggest dick on the WWE roster. He has done a fantastic job of turning the crowd against him over these last couple of months, behaving like an asshole and getting people to hate his guts. I think it's a natural extension of who he really is, and so it comes easy for him. He is a much better heel. But to say that Punk needed heat, boy, this guy really was floundering. He was having a lot of trouble. So, you know, they used this angle to finally help get him heat. So that's why they did the angle. That's just complete nonsense. Now, having said that, where do I stand on all this? Honestly, I was fine with the angle. I felt like I should be upset about it, but when it was over, I wasn't. I thought Punk played his role perfectly. I thought Paul Heyman played the role of slimy, sleazy little pig perfectly. And, you know, some of you are probably asking, oh, Solomonster, how could you condone such an angle? I'm not saying I condone it. I'm just wondering why everybody is so shocked. that WWE would actually do something like this. How long have you been watching this show? 2 weeks? 2 years? You really didn't think that they might pull something like this? I thought for what they did, it was fine. It didn't offend me. Maybe it's because it was different than other segments they've done before, where they bully people, like Jim Ross, where it comes off as completely demeaning and mean-spirited, just for the sake of being mean-spirited. It serves no real purpose when it comes to storylines or making money. I mean, you know, hey, Jim Ross nearly died, just like Jerry Lawler nearly died, okay? Jim Ross's situation, maybe it wasn't quite as extreme. He didn't have a heart attack. But JR almost died a couple of years ago and had to have 12 inches of his colon removed. They thought it might have been cancer. And Vince McMahon went on Raw and did a skit about it. He did a skit about the whole thing. He dressed up as a doctor and was pulling random objects out of JR's ass and laughing at him on national TV. That's far more offensive to me than this was, because in that case, he was doing it just to be a bully. Just because he can. I'm sure JR and his wife didn't appreciate that one too much. Even something like calling Mickie James Piggy James and talking about how fat she is on commentary every week. Same with Vicky Guerrero. To me, that stuff is much worse. Ain't no way Vince McMahon is mocking Jerry Lawler just for the sake of mocking Jerry Lawler. I'm sure he gave the okay for it, just like he did when they had Michael Cole making fun of his dead mother during their angle last year. And that was pretty low rent too, if I remember correctly. That you know, bothered me, but this is how they operate. What it does do, and this is what you would think Vince McMahon would be more mindful of when he does shit like this, is that it reinforces every negative stereotype that people have about pro wrestling. People think that wrestling is sleazy, it's seedy, it's dirty, and you know why they think that way? Because it's true. Pro wrestling is right up there with prostitution as one of the seediest industries in this country. I know that's a bitter pill for some of you to swallow, but that's what it is. That's what you like. That's what I like. I love pro wrestling, despite all of its faults. But I accept the fact that it's run by a bunch of greedy, selfish promoters. I accept the fact that sometimes I'm going to be embarrassed watching it on television in front of other people. I can think of no other TV show I watch where I would sometimes be embarrassed to have it on in the room with other people there. I accept it for what it is. But it blows my mind when these people wonder, why won't car companies advertise with us? Why can't we get the same sponsors that the NBA and the NHL gets, especially when our shows, you know, attract more viewers? There's a lot of times where Raw has more people tuning in than an NBA game or an NHL game. I mean, it's stuff like this that lost Linda McMahon the election. Not this angle, obviously, because this happened after the election, but shit they've done over the years like this that most non-wrestling fans would look at and just be completely appalled by. That clip of Linda McMahon kicking Jim Ross in the nuts the night after they fired him back in, I think it was 05, which actually came before, just before he had that colon issue, if I remember correctly. Now, you could say that was unfair for her opponents to use against her in the campaign, and they did. You know, it was all just a TV storyline. That's not fair. But it's that. It's making Trish bark like a dog. It's forcing one of your performers against his will to go on television and say, "Eddie's in hell," after Eddie Guerrero dropped dead in a hotel room. It's that sort of shit that will come back to bite you on the ass. You can't run from it. That's what amazes me more than anything else when they do shit like this. Because there will come a time where they complain, "Oh, you know, woe is me. How come the media treats us so unfairly?" Because you make it so damn easy for them. And I have no sympathy for you. You deserve it. You get everything you deserve. You know, some people will argue, well, it's only a TV show. People wouldn't get so bent out of shape if this happened on House or CSI or something like that. And that's a valid argument if you consider yourselves purely entertainment. If you are entertainment and nothing more, you can make that argument. The problem, I think, is that wrestling is so different than anything else on TV. It's live action. It has that in common with real sports. You know, in fact, I think they have a bit of an identity crisis in that they call themselves sports entertainment. When they spit out those self-filleting did-you-know facts on Raw about how SummerSlam was ranked number one in the sports DVD category, they emphasize the word sports. Probably more just to stick it to UFC, to be honest with you, but you can't have it both ways. What are you? If you're also going to consider yourself part sport, then just try to imagine Phil Simms suffering a heart attack during an NFL game on the air, and then coming back on the air 9 weeks later. Do you think they would air clips of him collapsing up in the booth, and then have Shannon Sharp mocking him back in studio? Can you even fucking imagine them doing something like that? Of course not. And I think you have a lot of people who see wrestling as this live-action sport, really, and not so much as a TV show like The Walking Dead. And so, to them, it's far more real, and it offends them when they see something like this. But still, nobody should be surprised by what they saw Monday night. Nobody should be surprised. And so all the people saying, well, that's it, you know, they're not getting my money anymore, I'm never watching WWE again. There's a lot of people who write into me and tell me they haven't paid for a pay-per-view in years. So I could believe that. They may well have turned a lot of people off to buying their pay-per-views, for example. But to all these people saying, oh, I'm never watching WWE again after this segment, 96% of these people will be back watching the show this Monday night. It's complete bullshit. I hear it all the time. You want to know what actually did offend me? Because, you know, even though I was fine with the angle itself, they did do something that I thought was appalling on this show. And that was airing that video that preceded the angle with Lawler showing him, a clinically dead man, mind you, laying lifeless on a stretcher while they performed CPR. And used a defibrillator to try to shock him, literally shock him back to life, to try to get his heart beating again. They had a cameraman filming the entire thing, right there with the camera right in the faces of all the EMTs. And what must they have been thinking when this was going on? You think that might make them a little bit nervous, having a camera shoved in their face while they're trying to save this man's life? Knowing that if they screw up, it's going to be caught on film? But even worse than that, they actually aired the sounds of Lawler snoring as he slumped over from the heart attack. Not only did they air it, they enhanced the audio. They made it louder so everybody could hear it. That, to me, was far more offensive than the angle they did with Punk. The angle they did with Punk is par for the course with WWE. It's a wrestling angle. You can say that it's in bad taste. I would agree. I'm not saying it wasn't tasteless. I'm just saying I didn't have a problem with it. Maybe because I was half expecting it to happen. Didn't offend me. This bothered me. We didn't need to see that. That video was so much worse than anything CM Punk did or said when he came out. By the way, when Lawler got on the mic, Jim Ross quietly slipped away off camera and disappeared, so we did not get a three-man announce booth on this show. JR is gone, and we are back to Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler as your Raw announce team. No truth to the rumor that as JR came through the curtain, Vince McMahon called him Fat Boy and threw a bottle of barbecue sauce at him. Not that I would be surprised if he did, but he had to be nice to JR because they needed him. And now that they don't, he could go back to making fun of him. Mick Foley ended up coming out to confront CM Punk. He was very upset by his treatment of Jerry Lawler. Punk correctly told him that he no longer had any business with Foley because it's no longer Team Foley against Team Punk at Survivor Series. And with Ryback being taken off Team Foley, he now had a gaping hole to fill in his team. And Foley said that he wasn't going to be the one to fill that hole, but the WWE Universe was going to have the power to vote for who they wanted to see fill that final spot. And what a choice we were given. Santino Marella, Zack Ryder, and The Miz. The same Miz that quit Team Punk before it became Team Ziggler. I was so hoping everyone would stuff the ballot box and vote for Santino just to prove a point to this company. I hate it. Whenever they do voting, where they talk about putting the power in the hands of the fans, and then they offer such horrendous options that you basically have no choice but to vote for who or what they want you to vote for. Power to the people, my ass. And it was a risk for them to do this, too, because you could easily have had, for example, Zack Ryder, you know, Mr. Social Media himself with almost a million Twitter followers, pick up more votes than Miz, who most people still view as a heel. At least earlier this week they did. Now he's a babyface. Babyface Miz. I don't mind it. You know, he was going nowhere as a heel. I ranted about him being even included on Team Punk in the first place. But, you know, now he's got a Christmas movie coming out. I think it's on ABC Family. And he's next in line to be the Marine. You know, it used to be John Cena. Then it was Ted DiBiase. Now he gets to be the Marine. So I guess they want a more wholesome Miz. And if he could get a win streak going, who knows? You know, maybe he'll get over. He had the people chanting his name on Monday, but that's only because they were in Ohio, which is where he's from. Bring him to the Garden in New York, and let's see what kind of reaction he gets. Miz won the vote, by the way, earning him the final spot on Team Foley. Maybe it's all just a swerve, and he'll cost his team the match at Survivor Series, and then he'll work a match with Foley at the next pay-per-view. Not that I want to see that. Mick Foley should not be wrestling anybody, but I put nothing past these people. We had an 8-man tag team match pitting Primo and Epico and the Primetime Players against Justin Gabriel, Tyson Kidd, Rey Mysterio, and Sin Cara. This was a hell of a match. I really enjoyed this. This was the best match on the entire show. Just so much happening at the finish. It was hard to keep track. Fast-paced, lots of action. We had some Nexus-on-Nexus violence at the finish with Justin Gabriel pinning Darren Young with the 450 splash. So thumbs up. I enjoyed this a lot. We had R-Truth beating Tenzai with Antonio Cesaro on commentary at ringside. Poor Tenzai. What has become of this man? Just get him out of this horrible gimmick and just make him Paul Heyman's heavy or something. You know, anything but the Japanese crap. Once they took away Sakamoto, he lost any appeal he might have had to me. We had Ryback and Brad Maddox in a squash. This right here was exactly what it needed to be. It was Ryback seeking revenge on the man who cost him the WWE Championship at the pay-per-view. Brad Maddox was petrified. He was terrified. They had an ambulance backed into the arena. They had a stretcher that they brought down before the match because this man's fate was already determined. This guy was going to be killed. He was the he was the Christian being fed to the lions, if you will. And Ryback destroyed this man. I don't think Maddox got any offense at all. Ryback just killed him. He gave him some really stiff power bombs too during this thing. It was like a triple power bomb and really brutal stuff. I thought, you know, he may have even concussed Maddox. I haven't heard that's what happened, but really brutal stuff. And in the end, he dragged Maddox's carcass to the ambulance and stuffed him in there, and that was the end of Brad Maddox. So I don't know if that's the last we're going to see of him on Raw. He's going back down to developmental. I don't know if he's going to be back on television in a month. But whatever the case may be, this was the definition of a squash right here. And that's exactly what you should do with Ryback. Ryback should not be in a position to be giving any offense away to Brad Maddox. Brad Maddox may have a bright future for himself in WWE, but not against Ryback. Not right now. Not in his first official Raw match. So this was perfect. Sheamus beat David Otunga with a brogue kick. I don't know whose bright idea it was to put Sheamus and Otunga, which essentially was just another squash match, basically right after the Ryback-Brad Maddox match. You know, you don't put those things back-to-back. That was just, I don't understand the logic behind that. Apparently, the Sheamus-Otunga match lost more viewers than any other single segment in Raw in years. It was something like 900,000 people or something ridiculous tuned out for this match. Shocking, I know, shocking. Kane and Miz beat the Road Scholars. Daniel Bryan was at ringside, very jealous of Miz being Kane's partner for the night. Bryan is very entertaining, but my biggest fear has basically come true in that he has become a total comedy character. And hopefully when his team with Kane comes to an end, he'll be able to transition back into a serious singles act, because this would be the kiss of death, I think, for anyone else's career. But I'm confident that Daniel Bryan is talented enough and over enough that he can overcome this. But again, anybody else in his same shoes, this would be the kiss of death for their career. John Cena and CM Punk was our main event on this show. Mick Foley had announced earlier in the show that he would be the guest enforcer at ringside. And the finish came when Punk tried to bail. Ryback came out. Punk ended up back in the ring and got caught in the AA, allowing John Cena to score the pin. Hopefully this means that Cena is the one taking the fall in the match at Survivor Series, as I said earlier, and Punk will retain. It was pointed out to me that there was a bit of a reshoot, something of a botch at the end of the show, which I had not noticed when it first happened. Cena and Ryback had a stare down in the ring, and then both guys reached down to grab the WWE title so they could do this sort of tug-of-war type deal with the belt. And the problem is, the belt was upside down. And Punk climbed up on the apron, then he immediately climbed down, and you could see Cena mouthed something at Ryback, and they both dropped the belt. Then they switched positions, and they picked up the belt again, only this time it was right side up. And Punk climbed back up on the apron so they could get the money shot of him standing in the background watching these two challengers fighting over his title. And that's how they went off the air. And as soon as I saw this, it reminded me of the pay-per-view after WrestleMania 20, where Chris Benoit, Shawn Michaels, and Triple H had a rematch for the World Heavyweight title. The Raw before the pay-per-view, they ended with this exact same shot, with Michaels in the ring with Benoit, and Triple H climbs up on the apron in the background, kind of standing in the middle, looking at both men on the inside. I don't know why I actually remember that. But that's what I thought of when I saw this. If these three guys could have as good a match as Benoit, Michaels, and Triple H did back then, we're in for a real treat on pay-per-view. Some other news here. SummerSlam. Next year's SummerSlam could be coming to Wales. That's the prevailing rumor going around, at least for the time being anyway. It is up for consideration. There is the time zone differential, which is a major strike against it happening, but if they end up getting SummerSlam, that would make Los Angeles the frontrunner for WrestleMania 30 in the year 2014. LA usually gets SummerSlam every year now, so if that streak comes to an end next year, and with LA not hosting WrestleMania since 2005, I guess that would have been when they did the whole WrestleMania Goes Hollywood campaign, they would likely get the honors in 2014. There was also some talk that the Superdome in New Orleans for WrestleMania could potentially happen, WrestleMania 30. But LA seems to have the most buzz right now. And quite frankly, I just can't see WrestleMania in Louisiana. I mean, I know they've had, you know, major sporting events there and whatnot, but WWE just comes off to me like they always want to be in a major city, like LA or New York or Atlanta. You know, Miami, where they had WrestleMania this year, back in New York next year. I don't know. WrestleMania in Louisiana, I can't see them doing it. I guess it's possible. It's certainly been talked about. Either way, we should know for sure within these next couple of months that's when all the decisions will be made, and we'll know more. Speaking of WrestleMania, I have a little bit of a WrestleMania buy rate follow-up. Several episodes back, I mentioned that WrestleMania 28 with Rock vs. Cena had officially surpassed WrestleMania 23 with the Battle of the Billionaires as the highest-grossing WrestleMania of all time. Well, not so fast. Buried within this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter is an item mentioning that this year's WrestleMania has, in fact, slipped back into second place as they readjust the number of buys. WrestleMania 28 now stands at roughly 30,000 fewer buys than the 2007 show, and that should be the final number. So, being that I went out of my way to mention it last time that they had broken the record, I wanted to set the record straight here and make sure that I gave the correct up-to-date figures. So, you know, still very impressive, WrestleMania 28, but the hair versus hair still trumps once in a lifetime, no pun intended. Impact Wrestling from Thursday night. I watched Impact Wrestling. I, for the most part, enjoyed the show, but if there was one thing that I came away from this show knowing, it's that one of their top baby faces in the company, that being one James Storm, is also the biggest loser in the company. Because you see, at Turning Point, which was TNA's pay-per-view last weekend, James Storm won a triple threat match to earn himself the number one contendership for the TNA World Heavyweight title. AJ Styles took the losing fall, which means that AJ Styles is not eligible for a shot at the World Championship for a year, until at least Bound for Glory of next year. So that's the storyline they're doing with AJ Styles. And James Storm won the match, earned himself a title shot. So what does he do? He comes out on Impact on Thursday night and is confronted by Bobby Roode. Or as James Storm would say, Bobby Roode. Bobby Roode comes out to confront him, and Bobby Roode plays him perfectly. He plays him like a fine-tuned instrument and gets James Storm so riled up. He had a line in there about how he was going to wait until James Storm's young daughter was of age, of legal age, 18 years old. And basically he said that when your daughter is old enough, I'm going to fuck her. He didn't use those exact words, but that's basically what he was insinuating. Again, pro wrestling, a very classy industry. Need I say more? So that made James Storm so upset that he, after only moments earlier refusing Bobby Roode's offer of giving him a title shot, because again, it would make no sense for him to put that title shot on the line, now all of a sudden, I'm going to give you a title shot. You got it. The match is on. And I knew exactly what was going to happen at that point. I mean, Impact was not live this week. I didn't read the spoilers, so I didn't know what was going on, even though other people probably did. But once I saw this, I knew exactly what was happening at the end of the show. And it never ceases to amaze me. I mean, it's not as though it's the first time we've ever seen a babyface be dumb enough to put a title opportunity that they earned on the line. We've seen it before in TNA. We've seen it in WWE numerous times over the years. James Storm is far from the first, and probably will be far from the last person who falls for this. But, you know, you have a guy here who has not exactly had a wonderful 2012. You know, James Storm beat Kurt Angle last year to become the world champion. And he was champion for all of a week or something. It was a ridiculously short period of time that he was the champion for before Bobby Roode smashed a beer bottle over his head, turned heel, won the title. And James Storm had his opportunity at the championship at Lockdown. He had a cage match with Bobby Roode. He gave him the last call super kick, and the finish was that he, James Storm, basically fucked himself over by super kicking Bobby Roode out of the cage to the floor. Bobby Roode wins. It's one of those bullshit finishes. And he screwed himself. Plain, pure, and simple, he screwed himself. He looked like a fool. And that pay-per-view, if I remember correctly, was in not his hometown. It was in his home state. So, you know, they built this thing up like you thought James Storm, this was going to be his crowning moment, and he was a loser. So then they did the storyline where he left for a while. Nobody knew if he was going to come back. And then he announced he was coming back. He was in the Bound for Glory series. They gave him like a 20-point head start or something like that. And the plan all along, if reports are to be believed, is that the idea was Bobby Roode would defend the championship against James Storm at Bound for Glory. James Storm would go through the tournament with his head start. He would win. And, you know, he would redeem himself in the rematch with Bobby Roode at the biggest pay-per-view of the year, and he would win the world championship back. And there would be this big celebration, and it would be a huge accomplishment. And somewhere along the way, plans changed. I don't know if it was, you know, Eric Bischoff or Hulk Hogan or who made the call, Dixie Carter, but they changed their minds. Austin Aries won the championship. And I thought that was great, too, because Austin Aries kind of came out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Austin Aries, great talent. Never really thought they would give him a shot with the world title. And they did. To their credit, he got over with the audience. They called an audible. They put the title on him. And I liked that idea at the time. The problem is, they kept the title on him, and they decided that we're not going to go back to the original plan of having James Storm win this tournament. James Storm basically got screwed over by the fact that Austin Aries, got popular with the fans. You know, it happens. So instead, we got a Bobby Roode James Storm match at Bound for Glory, but it was like the third match from the top. And they went out there, they had a great match. They had a bloodbath, they had thumbtacks, they had weapons, they were, you know, James Storm was wearing the proverbial crimson mask. They had a match that you would expect them to have in a pay-per-view main event, only again, it was third from the top. And so here's James Storm, after the shitty year that he's had, finally earning himself a shot at the championship. He has what he has been waiting so long for. And the very first show after Turning Point, only days later, he puts the title shot on the line against Bobby Roode, and he loses. Not only does he lose, the way they did the finish of that match, it's like he got tripped up and his face hit the exposed turnbuckle, and then Bobby Roode just basically like rolled him up. I don't remember. He may have hooked the tights also. It was a complete bullshit finish, but he lost. So presumably he does not get a title shot. Now I guess it's possible that it'll be like a three-way match. It'll be Jeff Hardy, Bobby Roode, and James Storm. I guess they could do that. But whether they do or they don't, the point is, the way this guy is booked just has to leave you scratching their head. Do they want him to get over? Is there somebody behind the scenes in TNA who has it out for James Storm? Because they've done everything in their power, seemingly, to make sure this guy does not get over, to make sure that this guy is looked upon as a loser. And remember, when they started the Aces and Eights stuff, you know, one of the things they did was planting the seeds of doubt about James Storm. Bobby Roode came out and said, he's the one behind it. It's James Storm who's behind Aces and Eights. And I guess the whole point was that people would see through it. They would see that Bobby Roode was being a bullshitter. But instead, you would watch Impact every week and see the reactions and hear the reactions that James Storm was getting. People started buying into the fact that this guy might be telling the truth. And maybe James Storm really is behind Aces and Eights. And all of a sudden, his great crowd reactions turned to shit. And people were booing him, and they were heckling him, or they were being lukewarm to him when he would come out. So that kind of backfired on them until they finally came out and had Aces and Eights attack him and you know, to prove a point, to prove that he, in fact, was not behind Aces and Eights. But all these things have happened to him this year that have really derailed his momentum. And this did not do him any favors. It just makes him, the big babyface, look like such a schmuck. Why would you put your title shot on the line after working so hard to achieve it? It just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, and this, again, it's been a constant in pro wrestling. It's one of those things that just makes you shake your head. It would be the equivalent of, you know, a baseball team going through the playoffs, right? And they win. They win the pennant. They win the National League pennant. They're going to the World Series. They have earned themselves a shot at the championship in the World Series. But instead, some other team swoops in, a team that was already eliminated. They weren't even in the playoffs. Here comes another team saying, you know what? Let's have a game. Let's have a game. And why don't you put up your spot in the World Series in this game? I mean, it sounds completely ludicrous, but that's essentially what happens in pro wrestling whenever they do this. You wouldn't see that in any other sport, so why do it here? It's so dumb. Anyway, I mentioned Turning Point before. I want to mention that Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries had one hell of a ladder match. It was a brutal ladder match. These guys killed each other in this match. I mean, Jeff Hardy took some bumps off the ladder, the way he fell. It's amazing he didn't come out of this match with broken bones or some sort of serious injury. Apparently, he was just, you know, he had the normal bumps and bruises. I'm sure he didn't feel too good when he rolled out of bed the next day. But hell of a ladder match. Just really brutal stuff between Aries and Hardy at the pay-per-view. And it's a shame almost, because you got to figure, you had, what, 8,000 people maybe watching that pay-per-view? I think TNA is averaging, you know, Bound for Glory you kind of take out because that's their big show. They'll tend to do more, maybe like 15 or 20,000 buys, you know, for Bound for Glory. But, you know, typically they're doing about 7,000 or so for their other pay-per-views. And these guys went out there in front of a very small audience that probably didn't even see the match, and they killed each other. And I just think they deserve a lot of credit for going out there and doing it. I will say one thing about Jeff Hardy. I want to bring this up here. I don't know if I've mentioned this before. What the fuck is up with those Jeff Hardy mind monologues that we get on Impact now? They had a segment on this show where Austin Aries went to go get a massage in the trailer, and Jeff Hardy was already in there getting a massage. And so Austin Aries basically says, you know what? You deserve it. You're banged up. You went through hell. I'll let you have the massage. And he leaves. And the camera then zooms in on Jeff Hardy's face, and it's in slow motion, and we hear Jeff Hardy's thoughts. Now, they've done this before on Impact, and I thought it was dumb, but I thought maybe it was a one-off type thing. Nope, they're going to do this all the time now. I don't get it. It's the corniest, cheesiest thing you'll ever see. I mean, how are we supposed to take this? Are we supposed to look at this as this show is not live? And which this week it wasn't, although normally Impact is live. And it'll be taped again this week because of the holidays. But are we supposed to look at it like this show is not live and this guy went into the studio, you know, post-show to record this? Are we supposed to actually think these are his thoughts? This is like Hulk Hogan seeing Ultimate Warrior's reflection in the mirror bullshit during the, you know, the their feud in WCW in 98, their infamous feud, when Hulk Hogan was having these, he was just panicking about the Warrior coming in. He was freaking out. He was losing his mind. He would look in the mirror and see Warrior's reflection, and Eric Bischoff would be like, I don't see anything. Just really corny, lame bullshit. That's what this is. They have to stop with these segments. It's just, it's weird. It's very, very bizarre. And I just, they need to stop doing it. Also on this show, this was the first Impact they went with their, apparently their new three-man announce booth. They used it on the pay-per-view. It was the combination of Taz, Mike Tenay, and Todd Kennelly. With Kennelly essentially being the play-by-play guy, and Mike Tenay doing analysis, and Taz doing whatever Taz does, you know, busting chops and stuff like that. They used the same announce team on Impact. I don't know if this is a permanent move going forward, but I liked it. I thought they worked very well together, actually. I think Kennelly has adapted very quickly in this role. I think he's fine. He's a fine play-by-play announcer. They also had a Knockouts Battle Royal, first time in 3 months that we saw Mickie James in there, and she won the Battle Royal, so she's the new number one contender for the Knockouts Championship. And they also announced that on Impact this upcoming Thursday night, Alex Silva, Taylor Hendricks, Christian York, and Sam Shaw of Gut Check fame would return to Impact Wrestling for Open Fight Night. Now, I don't like Open Fight Night. I've said this before. I like the concept of Gut Check. Open Fight Night, not so much. But I was so happy to just hear these four names even mentioned on the TV show, because all these people that have won Gut Check have disappeared. It's like the earth opened up and swallowed them, and we never heard from them again. And so apparently they're going to be on Impact this upcoming week. They'll actually be in action. And to that I say, it's about damn time that we see them back on TV. So I was happy to hear that. So those are my thoughts on Impact, just on the key things anyway from the show on Thursday night. Let's get to shout-outs and questions here. I have just a ton of questions to get to here. A lot of good stuff you guys sent in this week. Again, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. First thing I want to do is extend my thoughts and prayers to my friend Noah Mark. Noah's father passed away on Friday, and it's just a terrible thing. So please keep him in your thoughts. He's been a great friend, not only to me, but to this show as well. And he already knows this, but I'm thinking of you, buddy, and I'm here if you need anything. So my thoughts are with him. This first shout-out is a sad one. It comes from Orlando in Tampa, one of our longtime listeners. He says, I would like a shout-out from my brother Reese, who passed away on October 28th. He was 21 years old and was involved in a motorcycle accident. He and I always watched wrestling during the Monday Night Wars, and those are some of my favorite memories of him. Going through his photos, there was a picture from one of his birthday parties of him wearing a Stone Cold t-shirt with a wrestling ring birthday cake. On another note, Sunday the 18th is my mother Yvette's 52nd birthday. I would like a shout-out for her as well. With everything that has gone on, I would love to be able to show my loved ones the Sound Off and hear the Solemn Monster shout out my family during this time of loss. I am a huge fan and can't wait to hear you every Sunday. Thank you. I'm very sorry to hear about your loss, Orlando. 21 is way too young for anyone's life to come to an end. And it sounds like you guys were pretty close and had some fun memories together, which I know from experience you will learn, if you have not already, to really lean on those old times to help get you through this. And hopefully you and your family are doing okay. Happy birthday to your mom as well. I'm sure it's a bittersweet birthday for her, but she has another great son, so hopefully she can take some solace in that. If there's one lighthearted thing I can share with Orlando for a nice chuckle, every time he writes into the podcast, I can't help but laugh when I see a letter from Orlando in Tampa. I just think that's funny. One of our longtime listeners since the double digits, Bill Mitchell, or the professor, as I like to call him, felt compelled to write in after the Lawler angle from Monday night. Again, I got a lot of negative feedback to the Jerry Lawler angle. I can't get to everybody's letter, and perhaps Mr. Mitchell and many others will disagree with my little rant from earlier on in the show, but he was very upset by it and felt compelled to write in. He said, Hi, Solemn Monster. I don't have a question this week, more like a rant. This week, a lot of wrestling fans jumped on my case on Twitter about my not liking the mocking of Jerry Lawler this past week on Raw. Now, I love humor. I like funny things. In fact, this skit with Heyman and Punk had the potential to have me laughing so hard I would have tears streaming down my face. And that further infuriated me that it didn't happen. If Heyman had done a famous Fred Sanford impersonation, which is where I first thought this segment was going, that would have been funny. Granted, anyone born after 1990 would not have gotten the reference, unless JR or Michael Cole made mention of it. By the way, this is my Solomonster note here. Don't forget JBL, because after all, JBL actually did do a Fred Sanford impersonation, pretending to have a heart attack at the first ECW one-night stand, when Paul Heyman nailed him with that line about how he was only WWE champion for a year because Triple H didn't want to work Tuesdays. So, anyway, I digress. He continues on here. The fact that they went over the top with the whole convulsing bit was too much. This was not attitude, he says. All of the WWE fanboys on Essie Scoops love to talk about how Vince McMahon for one night brought back the attitude era. Are you guys in the fertilizer distribution business all of a sudden? Soaking people in beer, giving birth to a white hand from a black father, and making fun of other factions and their mannerisms, those are acts of attitude. What was done on Monday night was disturbing and in very poor taste. They could have made light of a life-threatening situation in another way. They did not have to, if you'll pardon the cliche, hit too close to home. It was a slap in the face of not only a loyal employee of a publicly traded company, but it was a slap in the face to anyone who themselves or those who have had loved ones that have had to endure a life-threatening situation. WWE accomplished what they wanted. They wanted people talking about it. There is no such thing as bad publicity. By the way, as a PR person, I disagree with that. But anyway, this segment served as a chilling reminder of that, but don't you dare mask your dark, macabre fetish for making light of real-life events behind this so-called cloak of the attitude era. It is simply not applicable. That's from the professor, Bill Mitchell. Very upset. Speaking of upset, Sky Mishra from Facebook, another one of our listeners, also very upset. He said, it would have been more subtle for WWE to have brought Jerry Lawler out in an ambulance and have him resurrected by The Undertaker. I hated what they did with Punk. That video was effed up, too. I know Lawler okayed it, and they would have done this in Memphis, but I still will not condone this shit. Fuck this sad, pathetic company. It makes me sick that I even acknowledge this company exists, much less watch it. So that comes from Sky. Steve from New York City. I've been a listener since episode 203. And was wondering if I could get a shout-out for my 23rd birthday happening on November 20th. I doubt my birthday this year will be cooler than being in the garden seeing Never Before and Never Again last year. That was a Survivor Series. But a shout-out might help get that along. I also have a question about the Cena, AJ, Vicky, Dolph storyline. Do you think that, had Vicky been left out of the storyline, that a John Cena, AJ, Dolph Ziggler love triangle storyline could have been interesting? I find myself being interested in Cena, AJ, and their relationship, mostly because I think AJ would drive him nuts. Bad evidence segments aside, I don't think the storyline is all that terrible. What are your thoughts? I don't have a problem with them doing a relationship deal with Cena and AJ. I like crazy AJ a hell of a lot more than I did general manager AJ. It's just the blatantly ripping off a bad TNA storyline that I take issue with, and the complete lack of logic in that. It's supposed to be scandalous that AJ was dating Cena when Vicky herself dated and was even married to one of the wrestlers during her time as GM on SmackDown. I think it would be far more scandalous having John Laurinaitis as the general manager blatantly trying to screw with members of his own roster every week. I mean, really, any heel GM, if you think about it. Wouldn't that be more of an issue with the board of directors? That's really what I think is so stupid about the whole thing. I don't have any problem with doing a deal with Cena and Dolph with, you know, AJ in the middle. One of the best stories WWE ever told was the Triple H Stephanie Kurt Angle love triangle back in 2000. That was great stuff. At least it was until Triple H just beat Angle and killed the whole thing dead. I think the plan may have been to have Stephanie end up with Kurt in that storyline. And you know that Triple H was not going to have any of that. But that thing ended way prematurely, which is a real shame. But again, still a great storyline. That was really, those segments were great. All three of those guys back, you know, in 2000 when they did that, were right on the money. It was very entertaining. And I think they could do something similar if they wanted to with Cena and AJ and Dolph. But for the time being, it's just Vicky coming out, you know, putting forth evidence of what, why it matters, I don't know, and at least for now, it doesn't look like Dolph is involved in any sort of love triangle here, although I still maintain that when this thing comes to an end, it may yet come out that the person that AJ was fraternizing with was in fact Dolph Ziggler. Although you would think that if AJ was being falsely accused and mocked by these people every week, she would already come out and say it, so I guess maybe they won't go in that direction, but anyway. Kane Corey writes in, I have a strange feeling that rogue referee Brad Maddox is going to impact the main event on Sunday, perhaps attacking Ryback or distracting him after Ryback shell shocks John Cena, which results in Punk getting the pin and retaining. Do you have any thoughts on this? Yeah, I don't see it. Not after the beating that Maddox took on Monday night. I mean, he just got killed by Ryback in his very first match. To have him come out on pay-per-view 6 days later after such a vicious assault like that would be completely ridiculous. Now, that's not to say that we won't see a finish where Punk steals a pin from somebody and retains the title. I think it's very likely that we see something like that, probably on John Cena, so they could protect Ryback. But Brad Maddox needs to be kept off TV for more than just 6 days after the beating he took on Monday night. Mitesh Kumar writes in, how would you book the upcoming pay-per-views in order to have Rock vs. Punk at WrestleMania? It's simple. I wouldn't. I would do it at the Royal Rumble, not WrestleMania. Simple as that. His second question, do you think we might see Brock Lesnar kick John Cena's ass as retribution for the loss at Extreme Rules either before or possibly at WrestleMania? You know, I'd love to see it, I guess. You know, Brock Lesnar beating the crap out of John Cena. In fact, I would love to see that, but that ship has sailed. You know, they had their match. It was one and done. You've only got Lesnar for very limited appearances. Unless he's going to destroy John Cena to get to somebody else, I don't see the point in putting them back together and just having John Cena beat him again. So I don't see it happening. I don't need to see that. This comes from Raymond Pagella. Happy belated 5-year anniversary. I've been a fan of the show since episode 240. I've also been a big fan of R-Truth when he was a heel back in 2011. It seems the little Jimmy references were more relevant back then. Do you think R-Truth asked WWE to turn him babyface because he seemed more comfortable that way? Or do you think WWE in this politically correct PG era did not want a, quote, angry black psychopath as a character on its roster? He seemed more effective as a heel. On the flip side, do you think WWE turned CM Punk heel because his image of a tattoo-wearing Punk fan does not suit WWE's image of what a top babyface is supposed to be? CM Punk seems more comfortable as a heel, but he was a top merchandise seller for WWE. I would like to know the process by which a wrestler becomes a face or a heel. Actually, if I recall correctly, R-Truth got busted on a wellness violation about a year ago. It came out after Survivor Series, so they let him wrestle in the main event with Miz against Rock and Punk, or rather Rock and Cena, I should say. And it was after that that we found out he had a violation. I think it was for Spice, which is a synthetic form of marijuana. And that was, again, right at the height of his partnership with The Miz. And when they brought Truth back, the decision was made to basically curtail that push and turn him face, almost as a punishment. I don't think it was Truth's decision at all. As far as CM Punk goes, he always has preferred being the heel. He excels at it. They came up with a storyline explanation to do the turn, and they did it. Nothing more, nothing less. You know, he connected just fine as a babyface. Like you said, his merchandise was ahead of John Cena's at one point. I doubt that that's still the case, so, I mean, who knows, maybe it is. But it has absolutely zero to do with him not, quote, meeting the image of what a top face should be in WWE. What about the previous 10 or 11 months? Took him that long to realize that he doesn't suit the image of a top babyface? I don't think so. You know, there used to be a bald, foul-mouthed, beer-drinking guy on the roster who they pushed as the top babyface for years. And that worked out pretty well for them. I don't think they were looking to turn him heel because he didn't meet the requirements of what a top babyface should look and act like. David from London, England, who I had the pleasure of meeting at the Sun Life Stadium WrestleMania this year. Been a fan of the show since episode 103. As a big fan of both Edge and Chris Jericho, can you give me your top five matches for each of them? I would like to go back and watch them. Well, I can't sit here and give you five right now, but for Jericho, you know, his ladder match with Benoit at the 2001 Royal Rumble stands out to me, as does his WrestleMania 19 match with Shawn Michaels, his No Mercy match back in 08, the ladder match with Shawn. I think that was the match where Jericho had a tooth knocked out. That match might have been even better than their WrestleMania match. His matches with Rey Mysterio a couple of years ago were all excellent, one better than the next. As far as Edge goes, one of my favorites is his hair versus hair match with Kurt Angle at Judgment Day back in 2002. They had a match the previous month on the Backlash pay-per-view that was also very good, but that hair versus hair match, I just remember that as being a great match. I remember him having a fun cage match with Chris Jericho, I believe, on SmackDown around that same time period. His TLC match on Raw against Ric Flair was very good. WrestleMania against Mick Foley in the hardcore match. And, of course, all the ladder and TLC matches. The first Edge and Christian versus Hardy Boys ladder match from No Mercy back in 99 still stands out to me as being among their best. And of all the TLC matches, the second one, the one at WrestleMania X7, would be my favorite. That's the one that had the famous spot with Edge spearing Jeff Hardy through midair. I know I'm missing a bunch of other ones, but those are the ones that would jump out at me. Shaver Ramen writes in, "Can I get a shout-out for my girlfriend? She is a big fan of the show, and it was her birthday and our anniversary last week. P.S., could you tell her to please accept my calls, as I'm sure she is listening right now. I forgot her birthday and anniversary last week." Oops. Trying to make up for it with a shout-out, I see. Well, you know, if she's listening right now, I would give the man a chance. It happens to the best of us. I can't remember most people's names 5 minutes after I meet them, so I feel your pain. He also has a question. What are your thoughts on Fandango? Do you think this is what John Cena supposedly meant when he confronted Vince McMahon backstage a few months ago? Weeks ago? Months ago? I think it was weeks ago. Claiming that he is out of touch with the current product. First of all, I have very serious doubts that that even happened. That just screams news junk to me. As far as John Cena confronting Vince McMahon, I don't buy it. As far as Fandango is concerned, let's give Fandango a chance. You know, let's give the character a chance. In the end, it all comes down to how WWE books the guy. You know, I was totally into the Brodus Clay character. Remember that? When Brodus Clay came out as the dancing fat man? And I actually came on this show and I was excited. I said, you know what? This could work. Let's give it a shot. Let's give it time here. This could really be something big. This could be something fun. And it was fun for a couple of weeks, and then it died. And Brodus Clay now is, they gave up on him. They turned him into a dancing jobber. That's basically what he is. Let's hope Fandango is not the next dancing jobber. You know, sometimes these over-the-top gimmicks, they get over. Look at Goldust back in 95. People shat all over that thing. They called it the kiss of death for Dustin Rhodes' career. But that may have been the best thing that ever happened to him. Same thing with the Spirit Squad, who actually got over before being squashed and shipped back to OVW in a crate by DX. I mean, you just never know with these things. Let's give it a shot. This next one comes from Aaron. I've been listening to the Sound Off for the last 4 years. Can I give a shout out to my wife, Megan, for being married to her for 1 month? So far, so good, he says. I also had a question. If Hulk Hogan never did exist, who do you think would have been the guy in WWF in the 1980s? And do you think that guy would have made the company as big as it is today and was back then? Keep up the great work. Looking forward to many more years of the Sound Off. Hulk Hogan was the right guy at the right time. The only other person I could think of at that time in the company who oozed the kind of charisma he did would have been Rowdy Roddy Piper. And he was a heel. You know, they were looking for the next big baby face, and I don't think that would have been the right role for Piper. He was a much better antagonist. But the person who was super over as a baby face, and well on his way to becoming champion, most likely, I had always heard, was Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Snuka turned out to be his own worst enemy. He had major drug issues that basically derailed whatever push he would have gotten. You could argue it derailed his career. You know, there was also an incident with his girlfriend at the time where she ended up dead, and the belief in some circles is that Snuka murdered her and basically got away with it. In fact, the coroner in that case suspected foul play and reported it, but then charges never got filed. I remember reading that Vince McMahon was actually on the scene. He was speaking to police on Snuka's behalf because Snuka was pretending to not speak any English. You know, basically he was pretending like his gimmick was real. He was some savage who didn't understand English, couldn't speak the language, and the cops, I don't know if the cops knew better, if the cops didn't, but that's basically what Snuka was doing when they were trying to question him, and Vince was kind of on the scene to speak on his behalf. You know, Vince was there to protect his guy, basically. It's a very sordid tale. We'll never know what really happened in that case. You can Google the name Nancy Argentino. That was the name of the girlfriend who died. There's a ton of websites about this. There's actually a friend of mine, of my family, who was good friends with Nancy at that time. And to this day, you can't even speak the name Jimmy Snuka around this woman. It's just something you don't do. But anyway, Snuka fucked up. He never did become the headliner that many thought he should have been. And when WWE brought him back in 1989, he was nothing more than a mid-card act. You know, to a lot of younger fans, he's best known for being the first man to lose to The Undertaker at WrestleMania. That's his big claim to fame. You know, that and the coconut. People don't realize what a big star Jimmy Snuka was in the early 80s and was well on his way to becoming. You know? Now, if he was given the title and Hogan had not come along, I don't believe for a second that WWE would have gotten as big as it did. I mean, who's to say if they'd be at the point they're at now anyway? They just would have kind of taken a different path to get there. I'm not saying WWE would cease to exist. They would have gone out of business or anything like that. But back then, everything was built around Hulk Hogan. And he was a much better promo than Jimmy Snuka was. He could do all the talk shows. He could do all the media, all that stuff. And I just cannot see Jimmy Snuka doing any of that. So I think Hulk Hogan was the right guy for the right role at the right time. And they did the whole rock and wrestling thing. They brought in people like Cyndi Lauper and Mr. T, who also played a huge role, make no mistake, in that company skyrocketing to the heights that it reached. It was like a perfect storm where all of these things came together at once. You had Hogan as the big guy they could build everything behind. You had Roddy Piper was the perfect foil. He was the perfect guy to oppose Hulk Hogan at that time. And they brought in a couple of mainstream celebrities, and it clicked. And the first WrestleMania succeeded, and it just took off from there. But you know what? We'll never know if perhaps Jimmy Snuka could have been in that role, because instead, at the first WrestleMania, Jimmy Snuka was managing Hulk Hogan and Mr. T. He was at ringside for the main event. That could have been him in the ring, and instead he was at ringside. I think that that says it all right there. Shane Anthony writes in, I've been a listener since Sound Off 234, although I'm currently in the process of catching up on my history listening to some of your earlier podcasts. I really enjoy what I hear, and am relieved that I am not the only one quickly approaching their 30s that still watches WWE and TNA. Anyway, I have a few questions. Back on Sound Off 224, one of your listeners asked a question regarding whether you thought Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, or Owen Hart would be a world champion in today's WWE, and was very surprised to hear you dismiss the notion that Owen Hart would not have, in fact, been a world champion. Can you please elaborate as to why? I've always considered Owen to be a very good technical wrestler at the earlier stage of his career when he was having classics with Bret Hart and even Shawn Michaels, and believe that with time he would have gotten much better, dare I say, even surpassing his older brother. I know you're a big Bret Hart fan and just thought that I'd voice my opinion and find out your reasoning behind your statement. Keep up the good work. The fact is, Owen Hart was never looked at as a championship guy in WWE. If he was, he would have been champion long before he died. Likely, it would have been in 1994 at the height of his sibling rivalry angle with Bret Hart. By the time, you know, 1999 rolled around, which is when he died, he was already 34 years old. And he was relegated back to being a mid-card comedy figure. He was you know, the Daniel Bryan of that time in WWE, for lack of a better analogy. You know, even if I thought Owen should have had a run as champion, in 94, I mean, really 94 would have been the best time for it. It doesn't matter, because they were never going to give him the title anyway. There were two times when they could have put the title on him. 94, at some point during that year, they could have put the title on him after he won King of the Ring. Or when they brought him back at the end of 97. You will recall that when Bret Hart got screwed over in Montreal, and that was it for him in WWF, British Bulldog was very upset by what happened. He requested a release and actually had to pay the company, I think something like $150,000, just to get out of his contract so he can go to WCW. But they would not let Owen Hart out of his contract. And there were a lot of testy negotiations going back and forth. And ultimately, I think Owen signed a new deal. And he agreed to come back. And the idea was that Owen Hart would come back and he would challenge Shawn Michaels. I don't know that the plan was ever Owen would actually beat him for the title. But the month after Montreal, after Shawn Michaels beat Ken Shamrock at a pay-per-view, Owen Hart came out of the crowd, attacked Shawn, and they started a feud, but they never had a pay-per-view match. It's not like Shawn and Owen went on to the Royal Rumble then, in 98, and had a championship main event match. No, they did Shawn Michaels Undertaker Part 3. They did a casket match, and by that point, Owen Hart was right back to the mid-card. So I don't know if the plan was for Owen to be in the main event or actually win the title, and then they ended up changing their mind and screwing him over. I don't know exactly what happened there, but that would have been the other time that you could have put the title on Owen Hart. And again, I don't think that would have been the appropriate thing to do. Shawn Michaels was the heel champion. You were building to Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania. The timing would have been wrong to take the title off Shawn. But those are the only two times it really would have made sense, I think, to put the title on Owen. And they didn't do it. Because, you know, they just did not see him in that role. That's why I'm so confident he never would have been champion. It's not like I didn't like the guy. I loved Owen Hart. I met Owen Hart less than a year before he died. He was a very nice guy. And he had great matches. You know? But the fact is, they didn't look at him that way. And to be honest, he was also just an average promo. He was a very funny guy, very witty. But he was never a guy that could get by just based on his promo ability. You know, it wasn't like he was out there dropping pipe bombs every week. You also mentioned how technically sound he was. But, you know, if we're shooting here, quote unquote, and we're not talking kayfabe, that doesn't mean anything. There's lots of technically sound guys who don't become world champion. I mean, if that were the case, Ryback would be curtain jerking every night. And guys like Daniel Bryan and Tyson Kidd and Dolph Ziggler would be fighting in main events. There's a reason you don't see that. Last one here comes from TJ, who actually just got his shout-out in just in the nick of time. I just got this email from him a little while ago, or at least I first saw it a little while ago. Dear Solid Monster, wondering if I can get a birthday shout-out. My birthday is on Tuesday, November 20th. I'll be turning the big 3-0. Also, I was wondering if you think Impact will ever go on the road full-time and get out of the Impact zone, and how much you think that would really help them. I think, well, first of all, happy birthday. I think getting out of the Impact zone would be phenomenal for TNA. I think that's exactly what they need. That's the next big step they could take. Get out of the Impact zone every week. Go on the road. It would be nice to see Impact in bigger buildings, but you don't want to be in a big building and only have a couple of hundred people because that just doesn't look good. But just get out of that environment. Go on the road. You know, they had some Impact tapings, I think, earlier this year. It might have been in North Carolina. And the way they set that up with the stage, and they had a decent number of people in the building. It was a little misleading in that it was a big building and they didn't have a lot of people. But TNA does a very good job of taking the people they do have and kind of organizing them in such a way where it looks like a packed house. And it felt like a big-time show. I think they may have done a show overseas as well earlier this year. Maybe in the UK it was. And it was a great atmosphere. And I think that would be huge for TNA. The problem is, do I see them going on the road full-time? Not anytime soon. They can't afford to do it. It's a very expensive thing for them to do. And Spike TV would have to kick in the money for that, and Spike just is not willing to do that. Now, there may be tapings here and there where they go on the road, but as far as full-time, I get the impression it's just too expensive, and Spike is not ready to make that commitment. And if Spike doesn't make the commitment, TNA simply can't do it. So that's just how it is, unfortunately. But would it help them? Absolutely. It would freshen that show up a lot, and it wouldn't be performing in front of the same people every single week, because after a while, people get burned out on that, and it gets old. And it's nice to get out. It's nice to be in different places. And at some point, hopefully they can do that, because I really do think that's the next big step for that company as far as freshening things up, broadening your horizons, expanding your audiences. I think they have to. It's just that right now they can't. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. I want to thank everybody who wrote in. I got a ton of questions, some I didn't get to. I will try to get to yours next time. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you send and try to respond, so email me there if you have shout-outs, questions, comments, all that good stuff. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is my handle. I may be doing some live tweeting during Survivor Series tonight. I always do it during Raw. each and every Monday night. And if we ever do a Twitter-only mailbag for the podcast, you'll want to be following me on there. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the easiest, quickest shortcut to our official Facebook profile page. You can send a friend request to me, and that will give you access not only to our weekly raw debate thread that we have on the Facebook page, but there's some secret files, some secret photo galleries on the page as well that you might enjoy. And you have to be a friend first to have access to that. So friend me on there, and you can also find us on iTunes. You can subscribe to the show for free, and every time a new episode is posted, it will be automatically downloaded for you, but you already knew that. That's how iTunes works. So type in Solomonster Sounds Off and subscribe to us there. And I very much appreciate any sort of feedback that you leave for me in iTunes. A lot of people have left reviews, you know, have given star ratings for the show. It helps us each time you do that. So if you could take a few moments, I very much appreciate that. So that's going to do it for episode 246. We'll be back next weekend, I guess, with a Survivor Series postmortem. We are heading into the Thanksgiving holiday, so being that this is the final sound-off before Thanksgiving, I want to wish everybody out there who celebrates a very happy Thanksgiving. Hopefully you'll be spending it with family and or friends and not by yourself. And it's a great excuse to stuff your face and just eat a bunch of crap and then worry about losing weight after the fact. I love how everybody this time of year, they worry, oh my God, you know, the holidays are coming. I have to lose weight. Fuck losing weight. Just eat whatever you want. Have fun. Drink. Be merry. All that good stuff. I don't foresee changing the schedule of the show. I would expect to do a normal show next weekend. If there's a chance I could do an early one, I may try to do that. But otherwise, we'll be back next weekend with episode 247. And until then, be well, stay safe, have a great holiday, and we'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.